We are ready to begin, and for the sake of the tape ministry, my name is John Schramm. This is the second of two sessions on Theology of Cross, Theology of Glory. We started yesterday by having people share what Theology of Cross meant when we said that or put that on the blackboard, or what Theology of Glory meant when we put that on the blackboard, or to attempt to hold the two up and to compare the two, or to say, why would you say Theology of Cross, Theology of Glory? Why did Luther set them apart in order to contrast them? Why did he use those two terms? I'd like to start that way again today. If you were not here yesterday, it's a way for you to have input. If you were not here yesterday, it's a way for some people who were to say some things and to let you catch up. It's also a way for you, if you wish to say, before yesterday I thought, now I think I would say, in other words, if there was any shift in how you would answer, share that too. Would anybody be willing to start us off either on cross, glory, how the two contrast, keeping in mind we're talking about Luther's use of the term? You were more ready to do it yesterday than you are today.
I would say a theology of glory would be a theology that would negate the validity or the legitimacy or the necessity of the crucifixion, of the salvation act of the crucifixion.
Okay.
And would focus on a strictly triumphant God, not a suffering God.
All right. Two things he said. It would negate the necessity for the cross, and it would focus on a triumphant God, not a suffering God. Okay?
With the cross, God meets us where we are.
With the cross, or cross theology, God meets us where we are. Good. All right?
I spotted a little theology of glory in the hymn last night. It struck me
all right.
The first time. I always loved it, too, but that line about the great church victorious.
All right.
That's even pulling that glory over sort of onto ourselves, I think, if we view ourselves as a church. I don't know.
Good.
Possibly that whole hymn was a theology.
I don't know. I hope not.
In the winter, we started going through the hymnal, looking at hymns, and trying to have the possibility of theology of cross perceptions in our head, and then looking at the hymn. What we found was there's a lot of talk about the cross. Sometimes it's not really a very good theology of the cross in the hymnal. Glad you began to have your antenna. Right. Those are fine. Keep going.
I was thought before yesterday, or felt that the teachings of growing in my Christian faith were in peace. And I feel that it would be unrest. Okay.
I got you up until the last words, and I think that was the summary, so I want you to repeat it.
Well, that it's. Being Christian isn't necessarily an inner peaceful thing. The unrest, questioning is on the head.
Okay, all right. I'll have to be very careful because Mary and I helped write all of the materials for the ALC on shalom or peace. I don't want to give you a lecture that was not advertised. One of the really helpful things is to understand that we have come with our own perceptions of peace. Judy Madison said the other day, we don't see things the way they are, we see the things the way we are. Okay.
Yeah.
We have come with our understanding of pax as, look it up in the dictionary, peace. First meaning, anybody, guess. Tranquility. Calmness, tranquility. The Hebrew word shalom, when you look at Kittel's word book or Richardson's word book of the Bible, peace is used 350 times in the scripture. 230 of them are the Old Testament shalom. It is never inner psychological tranquility or well-being. It's a social concept. So when hymn 449, if you want one that is theology of the cross, hymn 449, and it's a new one, they cast their nets in Galilee, after Peter is crucified upside down in verse 3, which we let Marilyn Fenn sing because it's too high for anybody other than a soprano. The third verse has a different melody. The fourth one is, the peace of God which is no peace but strife sown in the sod, and then goes on to talk about the marvelous peace of God. That's peace. So we don't stop talking about peace. We understand peace in a way that Jesus was very clear about, not as the world gives, give I unto you. So we still talk about peace, but we have a way of doing theology or a biblical understanding of peace. That it's almost as though she fed me my line. Thank you. No, but that's a good comment. Rick.
Didn't he also then have a theology of glory, which is not a glory that is the theology of glory that we're talking about?
Okay, Roll Tweet came up after the session. As Luther uses the terms, sometimes I think we have to pause and say, when people honestly say, this is what I mean by that term, then accept that, and then we communicate. What happens 400 years later is we forget all the context, and we assume that when Luther used cross glory, they were contrasted things. And he had a specific content to glory. I said yesterday, one of the greatest misconceptions is that you will assume a theologian of the cross is one who's always gloomy. A theologian of glory is one who's happy, and I like happy theologians, or some such thing. He didn't cut out glory. In these distinctions, he made them contrasting. Roll and I even talked about, there's a hymn, in the cross of Christ I glory. We can, after the end of a couple days, come back and use the word glory again and use it in ways Luther was not talking about. There is a way for the Christian to glory. It's not the kind of pride, rejection of the cross, rejection of the idea that we are creatures or beggars, that is true, which is the last thing Luther said. Then we can begin to sing glory to God in the highest, on earth peace among men with whom he's pleased. But as he's using it at the Heidelberg Disputation, as he's using it to speak against indulgences, as he's using it to speak to a smug and complacent church, they are contrasting theologies and contrasting theologians. Does that help to clarify that again? Okay. You're doing fine. Keep going. What else could you say? Yes.
I think it comes up, too, in some of the new Christians that I've known. They said that they expected when they accepted Christ as their Savior that everything would be wonderful in their life from then on, that
right.
They would never feel at odds with the world or with themselves. And then they said they found to their horror, almost, that it was just the opposite. They never had the problems that they had after they had accepted Christ. And yet I think they also felt that they were able to cope with the problems better because they had a strength far beyond their own.
Okay, good. What I would like to do sometime is to have a group travel from Holden and do good music, and in between the songs, which were good theology of cross songs, have testimonies. And have the testimonies be more like St. Paul about what it meant when I believed in Jesus than the testimonies I hear most of the time that are done for 60 minutes with a plastic Christian smile that never changes, and there's nothing but success story. I don't know where that Christianity is found, and it's not a biblical understanding. But the real testimonies, like St. Paul, if you listen to him, what happened after he followed this Jesus of Nazareth? It's not without joy, but it does refrain from giving a kind of insurance policy that God is a giant bear aspirin and all pain will be numbed and all this other stuff that happened. There is a Chevrolet dealer in my hometown, and his testimonies are, once he became a Christian, he sells more Chevrolets. And his favorite text is the great draft of fishes. Once they believed in Jesus, they caught more fish. And he has a very simple cause and effect between faith and making more money selling automobiles. It just drives me up the wall to hear this guy. And he has the money to buy Christian airtime. So the people of my hometown get a good dose of that every day. He's a nice guy, but his theology, I think we have a right to question his theology. Judy has a poem about success, speaks to him. She asked me if she could share it, and it's right on.
I like success. Who doesn't? It feels good and inspires me and others. Have I begun to worship success? It's a gradual, subtle logic where I believe that a good Christian gets rewards and a good worker goes to church. Utilitarian faith. Love God and He loves you. Turn defeats into victories, like Jesus did. Rise to new heights in the Lord. Success theology. And you, Jesus, ignored all that. Resurrection was deeper than victory. It was sharing, struggling, knowing misunderstanding with people, and reunion with God. Not so much success as giving. Do I dare worship the struggling, searching, giving person, the one who risked and felt failure? Yes, I can worship one who is willing to abandon success in hope of reunion, reconciliation, and love.
Thank you. Let me do a little more reviewing from yesterday, just to keep things going around. One person came up afterwards and said, we didn't all get a chance to say what I would have thought. Cross glory, I would have thought Good Friday or death, Easter or resurrection. A kind of simple distinction between the Good Friday, Easter. Instead of that, the theology of the cross is a way of looking at both Friday and Easter. Do you sense the difference after yesterday? It would not be only one aspect of the life of our Lord, His death, and only one aspect of the life of the Lord, of our Lord, His Easter victory. Both cross and glory would be ways of approaching or perceiving all of the life, teachings, death, resurrection, church. They are ways of doing theology. They're not pieces of theology. I tried that yesterday. I think that was one of the times when I went about 5 minutes and said it about six times until I got three of you saying yes and I knew I could go on. For Luther, if von Loewenwich and some others, and I'm going to give you a few more resources today, if they are correct, it was Luther's theological method, not just part of Luther's theology, which he tended to emphasize. There's a difference. It's a think with. We went through that yesterday. It's at the top of the board because for Luther, you either are a theologian of the cross and then you'll approach all of these other things like our place in the world, the mission of the church, the stance of the church, the style of the Christian life, servanthood or domination, your understanding of Holy Scriptures, that's descriptive or definitive. It will be a way you come at the theological and ethical questions today. If you're a theologian of glory, and Luther maybe made a too easy distinction, but if you follow with him, you'll come at all of those other things differently. So it's not a piece of theology. Another way you could have looked at those, and I hope has been blasted, theology of cross, theology of glory. One would be the churches and the theologians that stress this life. The other refers to theologians or churches that stress the life to come or the afterlife. Those who speak more about our life in this world and those who speak more about heaven. That's, again, inaccurate. Sometimes I have to pause so that you know I'm illustrating, not lecturing. That would have been a too simple misunderstanding of cross glory. Both of theologians of the cross and theologians of glory would talk about this life and the Christian hope of the life to come. Not one talk about one and one talk about the other. You feel the difference? Okay. We talked more yesterday about clarifying glory than we talked about clarifying cross. That's why I just paused at that point. Theology of cross is not only the death of Jesus, it's who he was, it's where we meet God. Mary said we sold out of Ferdy's Where God Meets Man. I told you that I thought if somebody was going to write a theology of the cross, that was probably the best title because it said that the key thing in understanding a theology of cross is where does God meet us? And Bill, I think, was within the first two or three comments today, talked about that aspect of theology of the cross. Nature of the Christian life, our stance in the world, nature of our hope. If you listened to Eric Jorstad the other night, he read a little poster from the bookstore. The author of that poster is John Howard Yoder, who has been on the faculty at Holden. If I remember an approximate, there are 3 points on the poster. The cross is that path freely chosen of following Jesus. It's the price of social nonconformity, and it's living out in an unwilling age the kingdom, the new creation, which is to come and which has come in Jesus Christ. Those things go beyond the hymnal's understanding sometimes of cross. It goes beyond vicarious atonement and Jesus' death as a propitiation for our sins. That certainly is part of the scriptural message. Lutherans have tended, unlike Luther, to concentrate only on the vicarious atonement instead of those other aspects of what cross meant. If these two sessions have inspired you at all and you want to really go further, Yoder's book, The Politics of Jesus, takes up that aspect with which most Protestants and certainly most Lutherans do not explore, and that is, Jesus said to his disciples, or said to those who were potentially disciples, take up your cross and follow me. Very simple statement that Yoder then makes. Do you realize that Jesus said that before he died on one? Well, all of us say, yeah, he did. He hadn't died on one. Then Yoder, have you ever thought of what that must mean? And most of us say, no. It means it had a content. It was understandable. People responded by dropping their nets and following. It was a powerful word before it could be the symbol of Jesus dying on one for the sake of the world's sin. Yoder says, what does the symbol mean? What could it have meant? And historical research indicates that it probably was a recruiting slogan for the zealots. That it was the way in which those people who were freedom fighters, trying to be freed from Rome, the bread is rising, or freedom now, or I don't know what they're saying in Swapo in Namibia right now with 90 people with a hit list that includes our Bishop Domini. Whatever the Swapo say to one another when they say, let's go, take up your cross and follow me, had that kind of understanding of the price of insurrection, of the price of social nonconformity. Jesus had at least one zealot who responded, Simon the Zealot, and if you study more New Testament history there, the speculation is maybe at least 6 of the 12 were zealots. So the discussion constantly was whether or not you also went with the zealot option of violence or not. But the fact that you were socially nonconformist was very clear from their cross language. I can't go farther this morning or we won't get on with our task. That's an area that Lutherans have not been very strong in. That also is cross. That it's not just a theology about the cross, but it's a theology of the cross. That's where I ended yesterday. I'll read that, and then we will move on to new material. Luther, quote, on the Magnificat, you must not only think and speak of a low estate, but actually come to be in a low estate, to be caught in it without any human aid, so that God alone may do the work. We are Christians and have the gospel, which neither the devil nor man can abide, in order that we may come into poverty and lowliness, and God may thereby have his work in us. That also is Luther's theology of the cross. Let me give you a few more illustrations, and then we'll come back to, I'm going to start with some concrete things you already have, and then we're going to take some new material and then come back to some concrete illustrations. I think we live in a culture. Douglas John Hall, Enlighten Our Darkness. I said I'd give you some more references. This is the most provocative attempt at finding what Luther's theology of the cross might mean for us in North America. He is Canadian, so when he speaks, he's speaking about those of us in the United States and Canada. He feels that Luther's theology of the cross, even though he comes from a Calvinist background, is the theology which is most helpful and can speak to our present condition. He feels, and the subtitle of this book is Toward an Indigenous Theology of the Cross. In other words, find in our context the way that Luther's distinctions might help us shape or form a theology. One of the reasons he says that is he says we find ourselves in an officially optimistic society. And when that's the case, a theology of the cross is very hard to formulate because we tend to be conformed to the world around us rather than letting our theology form our perceptions. We tend, Romans 12, do not let the world around you shape you into its mold, Phillips translates those words, and too often we find that that happens. So in the midst of this theology of the cross, can it be an indigenous one? Can it speak to our present condition in an officially optimistic society? One of the things that is very difficult to do in an officially optimistic society is to face failure. And Douglas John Hall thinks that we're about to have to face the failure of our dream. The dream of mastery and the dream of building the kingdom according to our understanding. And says, whereas the Christians or the religious people in any society should have helped people be able to face failure, we have been those who insulated the society from failure. In fact, we may be least able to face failure because we've had a theology of glory. That's the thesis of the book. Let me tell you what some of the illustrations that I have of why I think he's right. We had a group come up to Holden. Unfortunately, there was a misunderstanding. We thought they were coming for the regular Holden program. They thought they had rented the facility. And when we looked at the correspondence, it wasn't really anybody's fault. It was a misunderstanding. So it made for an awkward situation. They brought their own faculty. And so what we had to do is run parallel programs for a while. Well, it was the end of September, and we had only a couple hundred people in the village, so we could find space. But it was kind of a funny feeling, because that doesn't happen very often. We invited any of them to come to our things when they had time, and there was a somewhat veiled invitation that our staff could come to their sessions, and some of our staff did. One of the staff came up to the chalet about to explode after one of the sessions. I hope I'm not unfair, because I was not at the session. It was a session for the women only of this group. It was 1 hour, and it was basically how to do your hair, how to put on makeup, how to walk, and how to point. The staff person went through, I remember the pointing. It's a whole session on how to be beautiful. And this staff person is beautiful. She didn't need any of that lecture, but she was the kind that the group that came thought needed the lecture especially. She didn't point correctly and all of it. She went up with what I thought was a very legitimate question. She said, I understood the lecture, or I understood your session if you want to have it. What does it have to do with the Christian faith? Because they advertised it as Christian woman or something. And the answer was this. My dear, if you are not beautiful, men will not be attracted to you and will not come up and ask you about Jesus. If I had given that illustration to the staff in the summer, they would have thought, oh, come on, there's nobody who says that. Here they had 60 people for 3 days who said those kinds of things the whole 3 days. Why in the providence of God the other group that we knew was coming for the Holden program didn't come, I don't know, because I just wished for the whole 3 days. It's the Sheltered Workshop from Wenatchee. And I wanted to say, is he walking all right? How in the world can you take the gospel of Jesus Christ and end up with that which is not what I just said? You start listening for theology of glory, and you'll find it. You'll find things like that being proclaimed as good news and being proclaimed in the name of Jesus. Edna Hong, who's come to Holdenhoff and has a delightful little book, The Downward Ascent. You already feel the perceptions of theology of cross, don't you? The Downward Ascent. It starts by part of the motivation for the book. She read in the Northfield paper, or in some paper, that in Northfield every Saturday morning there's a group called Women Aglow. And she remembered the literary phrase Women Aglow. She wanted to put an ad in the Northfield paper at the same time for Women Ashudder. Or Women Who Fizzle. Or something to say, you can come to our group even if you don't glow. Now, let me be fair to Women Aglow and to that ad. I think that most of us who would go to Women Aglow are in fact people who wished we could glow. And that would be more honest. There's nothing wrong with being able to say, I don't glow and it hurts. That's what the gospel's all about. The poor, the maimed, the blind, the lame. Who's invited to the party? But that other is just too heavy a trip. If God loves a winner, what do I do when I'm not a winner? Can you feel the burden of that which is advertised first as good news, and then you've got to carry that thing? There was a rescue mission type thing. You've been to them. I hope you've been to them, because some of them are really good people in the middle of the city. We've made fun of rescue missions. I think some of them are at least trying. When a certain project is criticized, I think they ought to answer, I like my way of doing it better than your way of not doing it. Because some of them are at least trying. Anyway, at this particular rescue mission, one night they had a particularly obnoxious speaker. That happens too. It happens in the best of churches also. What the speaker did was quote, is it Rudyard Kipling? If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, it ends, you'll be a man, my son. But those, you remember that? If you can, and from the back of the room, some poor alcoholic done in by the day and done in by his own drink said, and what if you can't? The gospel is for that poor guy who knows he can't. That's what this is all about, finally. It's not some way of saying God wants your life to be gloomy. It's some response to life as we have in fact experienced it. You do not need the New Testament to tell you that life is filled with despair and that we are basically weak. The morning paper will tell you that, and your own guts will tell you that. Theology of cross is talking about the one who meets you as you are, where you are, back to where God meets man. Does that, you see, if they give me two sessions, by and large I teach, but I can't have it without some preaching. What the last 5 minutes was I know, I can feel the difference. Now I'll go back. Okay, yes.
Someone this summer has been asking a question. I don't remember if it was Mark Gibbs or Bill Neal or someone has been asking a question. They were referring to a young woman who was an executive with the Bank of America in San Francisco, whose complaint or question to the pastor was, what does the church have to say to me when I feel like I'm on top?
All right.
She was feeling strong in the faith, feeling strong in her work, feeling credible, her question, what does the theology of the cross say to people who feel like it's really going well for them?
Yeah. Okay, let's take that. I said by today we would spread it out. Let's take that one. You work for Bank of America, and that was a particular illustration. This happened to be a female who finally made it into the top echelons of corporate financial America. And the complaint was by the speaker and by this person, the church does not say much Sunday after Sunday about how I live out my life as a vice president of Bank America or some such thing. Theology of cross, theology of glory, what's said and how does the church faithfully minister with the theology that we wanted to have, a biblical theology, to that person?
That reminds me of that example you used yesterday, that it's difficult when you own the bakery to be grateful for the bread. And one would cease to see life sometimes as a gift when you're on top. And that might be important in the theology of the cross, to recognize it. The whole thing's a gift.
Okay.
The other thing is that the church that does not challenge those of us, all of us in this room who have terrific resources and possibilities. A lot of us here are on top. And we don't look for the possibilities that are available to us. And the church lets us off the hook. And I mean, it's us though that have an opportunity to preach and share. Because, you know, the woman that's on top, or myself, or whatever it is, you can't get away from the possibilities that are before you in the world. I mean, and that's what the cross calls us to be just in that tension, to be spread open.
Okay. Yes.
People on top, if they have a responsibility to minister them to the ones that are still struggling, because everybody who's on top of it has gone through a lot. I think you don't just get there and sliding downhill. And I think then you can use your experiences to help others. For instance, people who've had a long and successful marriage have not always had an ideally happy marriage. They've probably gone through some rough periods too. And I think it's up to them then to go back to the younger couples when the younger couples need help and say, this is what we found valuable. It's up to the older mothers to minister to the younger mothers. This is how I found strength. Or even if you can't say that, just say, you know, hang on, you're going to make it. And I think that's how those of us in the church who feel like we're on top of things a little bit can really be challenged by helping those that we see struggling with.
Okay, here and then Rich.
What I was wondering is, it seems to me that I'm really getting muddled up. My mind getting screwed up. It seems to me like I'd like to have you talk to the Pacific Lutheran folks so that, you know, winning it, being number one, is important to him. And it seems to me like that, see, I'm a coach. Mm-hmm. And if I don't really work hard and put everything I have into trying to win, then I'm not going to. And if I'm not going to, then I'm not very successful in the eyes of my school, mm-hmm. which then I need a job here.
Let me speak to that, and then Rick. I think there are two possible false responses, two prevalent, inaccurate responses to what Marty has raised. One would be to say, you must find an unambiguous place to work. Bank AmeriCard is ambiguous. Find a place to run the ALC's financial department or some such thing, as though that's a ladder theology. That's saying, don't get your hands dirty and stuff. One of the things would to say inevitably that you've got to find a place where you... where you're not in with those kinds of people, because sometimes in some settings those kinds of people are the rich rather than the town reprobate and what have you. In other words, your outcasts vary depending upon which group you're talking to, but they both are a denial of the gospel. Secondly, we have just as much prevalent understanding that you could not possibly think of quitting your job for the Christian faith. That's simply not true. The history is against you of people who did not compromise and who therefore found other ways or didn't get along very well and were unemployed rather than compromise. Okay. I haven't answered Marty yet, and we're coming at it, but it seems to me that a very conscientious young coach at Franklin High School in West Virginia, who coached my son, who said to him, "We're going to have a good time with basketball," who liked all the kids, who let them all play. They won 14 and lost 4, and the jocks in town got him out of there the next year. Yeah, he didn't win 16. He let that little kid play. He could have won that game. He's not a coach anymore. I love him. And I think a system where winning is everything is called into question by the Christian faith. Now the Fellowship of Christian Athletes could do a good job on theology of sports. Instead, they've really bought into theology of glory. I mean, I'd love to have some people, PLU coach and others at Holden. That's exactly what Holden's about, is to wrestle, because I think people are. But theologically wrestle. Perfect illustration of cross, glory, and athletics. Dallas Cowboys, just think of the stuff you could bring in to the Christian faith and athletics in the United States. I don't mean I'm glad we're messing up your mind. I'm saying all of us have those same places to wrestle with. And unless we see coaching career in the light of our faith, we're not really understanding that it's that kind of discipline, that's what Christianity is all about. So, I haven't answered you. I'm just feeling with you. You want to go on before I call on Rich?
Well, just only one other thing.
Okay.
That it takes guts or something to stand out in Christianity. Well, like right now, for instance, you're talking about a globe. Hey, I went to a globe meeting one time. It was, every bit as good as has come to a lot of your meetings here. You know, it was a beautiful meeting. They had a lot of good things. And I think that sometimes we ridicule things that aren't right, you know, without really knowing what they're all about.
Yeah.
So I really believe a GLOW is a good organization. But getting back to the coaching, that I don't think was a popular thing to say, you know. But nevertheless, it was what I think. But getting to the coaching is that I really believe that you're right about that guy, you know, and he did get fired.
Yeah.
And I believe that I'm willing to be fired, you know. And I have to believe that if the Lord knows all those stars and he cares about each hair on my head, then I'm okay anyhow.
All right.
And so I just got to put it out, that's all.
I think it's putting it out very well. Let me respond in two ways. What you said as a question is never unpopular at Holden. That's what Holden is all about, to put out where you are now struggling. The only thing that's not legitimate at Holden is for somebody to put you down because you might have a different opinion from anybody else in here. That's exactly what Holden's about. Secondly, I was not putting down Christians aglow, women aglow. Neither was Edna Hong. So I want to clarify that one. What she's saying is we have not only the right, we have the responsibility to think theologically and to share that theological insight. I gave you an illustration from a kind of Christians aglow or group that came here. I think we have a right to call into question the theology of why a woman is supposed to be beautiful that woman gave to the staff person. That's not making fun of the woman. It's thinking theologically. Edna Hong's point was the people who came, you went to a meeting and it was a helpful meeting. The people who came would have been served better if the name, and I don't know what all that ad in the Northfield paper said, if it had been straight out that these are people who would like to glow and it was a place where you could admit that you didn't all the time That's not only better theology, it's probably a more honest thing. And the heavy burden, that was my point, the heavy burden of if you're told, unless you're glowing, you aren't really faithful, or unless you're glowing, God doesn't love you, or some other groups I've been, unless you're making money, you must not be faithful. That's simply a burden that I cannot carry. The good news is the gospel tells me I don't have to. Now you're talking about the freedom of the cross. Does that?
On the class where the people were beautiful, they gave the wrong answer. I would say that if they would have said the answer is, hey, this body is a holy temple, and we should try to make it, you know, for instance, not be, try to learn how to get it in shape and condition and healthy and things of that type, that would come closer to the cross.
Would have been a lot better answer.
Yeah, okay. The answer wasn't good at all.
Rick?
I only had one question, and I think Coach came pretty close to answering it. I'm not quite sure when you say you're on top what that means.
Okay.
I mean, maybe a theology of the cross would help us define what it is we are on top of.
All right. One of the things up here is, finally, is Jesus a winner or a scandal? Or how about if we're talking about a cross telling us the style or stance that we take in the world? In the world, those in authority lord it over you. It shall not be so among you, but the greatest will be a servant. Does that say anything about what's the top? And is it a flip-flop from what the world considers the top? Yeah, I think that's part of an understanding of the Christian faith, is a different understanding. Downward ascent is where Edna's trying to get that. There's a congregation in Renton, Washington, Charlie May's pastor, just here on faculty 2 weeks ago. The congregation has as their theme for the year, for this parish in, I don't know, semi-affluent suburb of Seattle. I've been there. It looks like regular houses, but it's not poor. Progress as downward adjustment toward a theology of enough in suburbia. Not bad. Not bad for a congregation to do two things. To say the Christian faith gives us a different understanding and perception of progress. And it goes against the understanding presently in Renton, Washington, of upward mobility and all other things as to what progress is. Secondly, a theology of enough in suburbia, they are trying to find out how to live the faith where they live, because most of the stuff on alternative lifestyles recommend you either go to the woods or to the inner city, and that the real desert is suburbia. And here's a group of people saying, well, we can't all move. Let's try it where we live. I commend them on a perception of what's success or top or lots of other things. A coach is called to be successful. What the theology does maybe is change the definition of success. And I think the coach that coached my son had as success working with some kids and helping them grow, letting them have a good time, and when they won, they were happy, but that wasn't the whole bit, and he let them know that. My son got an idea of that. I think he was a successful coach. I don't want him to emulate. I don't want you to get the idea that the only way you have a theology of the cross is for that team to have 0-18 that year, 18 straight losses, and think then that's more Christian. And if you didn't raise those kinds of things, then I wouldn't have a chance to kind of fill it out a little bit more. Roll.
Certainly one accusation that could be raised against that very coach, however, is that in his being absolutely uncompromising to the jocks, he has deprived successive bunches of kids from his philosophy of life. And had he given in a little bit to them, and maybe one more game, he certainly must have been aware of the world. I think this is a question that not only every coach, but every teacher faces, and I'm sure every preacher faces too. What would theology of the cross say about giving in enough to maintain his job so that he could continue to do his good work. He's doing no good, fire.
What do you think the theology of the cross is?
I'm not sure.
What does somebody else think the theology of the cross says about compromising in order to keep the job, in order to help the boys the next year?
No compromise. No. Job.
Huh?
No compromise.
No compromise. No compromise.
I make a judgment.
That's judgment.
Right. What's really involved, and how much damage you'd be doing by giving in to those pressures, or how much good you can do by hanging around, trying to stay another season. You have to make judgments on this stuff. It's not just that cut and dry.
I think we could have a forum. Go.
I think we're saying, I can't compromise this. And you're almost getting back a little bit to the theology of glory a little bit. And you're taking so much pride in yourself. I've got
I might complicate it once more to mention John Wooden, who's now on the lecture circuit talking about how he builds Christian moral young men who never played more than 6 men in a game until he was 40 points ahead. And who was abusive to referees and whatever too, and his whole purpose right now is lecturing to people and giving camps on the Christian morality and in sports. So that's totally against what you were just saying. So I wonder how effective he would have been if he'd have played everybody and whatever too. So I have no answer, just a comment.
I've got at least three things going. You could put his lecture up against the Friends Journal editorial on the new games book and non-competitive sports as the only Christian sports that there are, and then you'd have your forum. Sure. No, I know there are differences of opinion. And we're still coming back to Marty. See, what we might say to the coach is what we might say to her working at Bank America. It really is. Let me. There was a Mennonite in Canada who was offered the job as a prison warden. Mennonites normally, I don't think, would take that kind of job. He stated his beliefs. They said, we'll go with you. He became the warden. All the guards were unarmed. All the prisoners knew there were no arms anywhere there. Things went fine for a year. In fact, it settled down. The first time the prisoners revolted, the board said, arm the guards. He said, nope, I told you that I would not do that. You know that. I will try to settle it nonviolently. I will personally go in and visit with the prisoners. He pulled it off. Everybody happy again. The next time it happened, they didn't give him the choice. They said, no, we're running this. And at that point, he resigned. He lasted about 2 years. One of the models would be, sure, you go into a place where you get your hands dirty, but at the point of choosing between effectiveness or faithfulness, you really are just fuzzing it up to say, in order to stay here and to have further work, I will compromise. The other stance would be, the world never has unambiguous places to stand. We all compromise a little bit. If you keep pushing that, you'll know why there are professors of Christian ethics like Larry Rasmussen. In other words, what you're doing is at least attempting to have those decisions, and they are tough ones, Rolf, to have those decisions shaped by your theology, by your faith. What I said yesterday was, if you listen to forums at Holden, so I'm assuming those are also forums at your church, the distressing thing is not that we have differences of opinion. The distressing thing is you will sit there and all of the arguments are on what is reasonable, what is effective, what is pragmatic, what has the best chance of success. And it's rare when somebody even says what is faithful to Jesus Christ. Whereas my assumption is that's the first question. You still may have different answers. I'm going to give one more thing and then move on, or then call on Richard. John Howard Yoder, in a little book called The Original Revolution, said when Jesus came, there were basically four responses to the relation between the church and society, or individual religious people and the world around them. Zealots, They wanted to overthrow. They wanted by violent means to run the thing. Essenes, they wanted to go out in the desert and find an ideal Christian community in the Cascades and live there forever. Pharisees, they wanted to make sure that it was possible to keep all of the Jewish dietary laws and all of the Old Testament, to worship the way they thought they should worship, and if that could happen, then they wouldn't really bother which government they lived under. Separation of church and state. If they could use the LBW and have a celebration of the unaltered Augsburg Confession, they could live in any country that let them do that. Finally, Sadducees, Herodians, were the people who said, we compromise. You make a deal with Herod. The art of the possible, making the best of a bad situation. Chaplains to a bad system, okay? When Yoder summarizes all four of those, and I would predict almost all of you are in that last, I don't see any zealots, at least you haven't talked like them. Most of you are not Essenes. You're going to go back to middle of Seattle or Yakima or wherever you live, and you're in the midst of the world. Pharisee, there's lots of us who are a little too much Pharisee. But finally, we're trying to make the best of a bad situation. We're compromising, the art of the practical. When Yoder summarizes all four, I just want you to know that having accurately summarized Herodian Sadducees, his one-line comment is, of all four options, this one tempted Jesus the least. We'll leave it at that, because I think Marty's question, Roald, who just left, Roald's question, a coach's question, those really are the place where all I want to do in these 2 days is to say that is what the Christian faith is all about, is attempting to relate an understanding of what it means that Jesus is Lord to those kinds of hard daily decisions. That's what we're trying to do. And I guess if I have any kind of push to you a little bit, it's be sure you ask the faith question first. It finally is more important than effective. That if you reread your scriptures, I do not think you'll find that they're asking you to carry the responsibility of making history come out right. And if you brought that burden to Holden and I just relieved you of it, I'm delighted. You got a bargain, no matter what our cost. If you think you have to make history come out right, you do not. If you just think that took you off the hook of all servanthood, let me add, all you have to do is be faithful to Jesus Christ. But that is a better burden. I'll give you one more good hymn. 529. His the cup, so dare it. His the yoke, so wear it. His the load, so bear it. That's a good combination of Luther's theology of the cross, 529. Luther said, in theology of cross, you will not understand it unless you understand that there is no cross without a gracious word. And he thought medieval piety told everybody to imitate Jesus and laid that on them as such a heavy burden that you couldn't do it. And he also said, there is no gracious word without a cross. And that's what we have in the United States today. A theology about the cross that says that God is a kindly old uncle with two beers under his belt. He'll forgive you anything kind of, I don't know what, without the experience of radical discipleship. So it's his the load, so bear it. The reason you can talk about faithfulness to Jesus Christ as a burden we can carry, can't carry the burden of making history come out right. You can carry the burden of his the load because he does bear it with us. I'm going to do one more. Oh, Ricky.
Yeah, I have a problem with the theology, but from a different
all right.
point of view. Maybe it's from being in Missouri Synod schools for 15 years, but, you know, I don't have any trouble feeling, you know, worm-like. I've been, you know, you're told day after day that, you know, you're a worm and God is all. Just a minute.
It's all right, we'll wait.
Anyway, I believe that. But I just finally had to. I couldn't deal with that finally anymore. And, you know, okay, so this is stupid. I'm sorry, I've been mulling this over for so long and I'm all wound up. I finally just had to have, you know, a series of little personal successes and stuff before I finally started to feel okay about myself. And I knew that God met me in my hour of deepest need and all that. But I still felt like a worm. And I don't think you can just live feeling like you're nothing and God is all. That's not enough, you know?
Okay. What? Yeah, absolutely. Okay. What does theology of cross, theology of glory, or what of the relationship between Friday and Easter, or the relationship of God's love when he meets us at our hour of deepest need, what was it that let theology of cross be something other than naming you a worm? I mean, do you now feel guilty that you no longer feel like a worm? Or, I mean, can you articulate more?
Well, I just can't. I've just closed myself off to the possibility of the sort of cross theology. I can't deal with that very well.
Okay, I told you yesterday I would share one section, which is what I think is the most important contribution of Douglas John Hall. Let's see if that helps at all, Ricky. If not, we'll talk more in a different way about it. I think it's 149. There is, all the same, no connection between pessimism and the theology of the cross. Now, the next statement I think is important, and I think Lutherans have misused it in just the way that he's talking about, and I think you've felt it. Every theological posture has its danger. No doubt the danger peculiar to the theology of the cross is that it readily lends itself to religious pessimism, melancholia, and despair. When it becomes that, it is not what Luther understood as the theology of the cross, but it can become that, and it can be misused or misunderstood as that. Now, I said this yesterday, but let me read it from Hall. Something altogether disruptive must happen to this theology before it can become the vehicle of a religious pessimism, i.e., it must cease to be a Christology. I said it differently yesterday. I said the only way a theology of the cross can be turned into a pessimism or a despair is to take Jesus out of it. And I think that's what happens too often. And it would be unfair if I had two sessions and didn't talk about that. You can hold your coffee for 5 minutes. I got one paragraph. It must not be overlooked that the whole intention of this theology is to bear witness to the incarnation. The theology of the cross is first of all a way of speaking about the character of God's entry into the sphere of human history. It is not just a statement about the death of Jesus. It's about his life and about the meaning of his life for our lives. It is not merely a statement about the human condition. It is a testimony to the assumption of the human condition by the one who created and creates out of nothing. The basic point of the theology is not to reveal that our condition is one of darkness and death, and then to stay there in that. It is to reveal to us the one who meets us in our darkness and death. It is a theology of the cross, not because it wants to put forward this ghastly spectacle as a final statement about life in this world, but because it insists that God, who wills to meet us, love us, redeem us, meets, loves, and redeems us precisely where we are, in the valley of the shadow of death. When that happens, it does not mean we have to stay there. And when he meets us there, the glory that we do feel, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross and despised the shame, will not be a kind of prideful thing, but will be the kind of gratitude that finally is more joy. You lose your life in order to find it. It doesn't end with your losing your life. The point of cross glory is, if you set out to find your life, you will in fact lose it. Can you feel the difference? Let me take one more as the end, and then the conversation, that's what's nice about holding, the conversation can continue at the coffee hour. Optimism and hope. My understanding on the basis of cross theology is, I probably am not optimistic. Daniel Berrigan was asked, how are you so optimistic about stopping the arms race? Where do you get that? He says, hope has nothing to do with optimism. I've never been allowed optimism. I've never seen things going well. I've seen only the continuous expansion of targets, the poor, the innocent, continuous evidence of our blunting our humanity. Then he skipped. The believing community has an entirely different basis that has nothing to do with cultural promises or political expectation. It has to do with the promises of Christ. It has to do with looking for an act of God, God's intervention. We are looking for this act of God in our own lives. Hope is the interplay between trust in the promises of God and the willingness to embody those promises in the way we live. Hope is finally more joyful than optimism. The basis of hope is in a very different thing. It's not based upon seeing that things are going well. It's based upon the promises of God. And so it always finds its glory in the right thing. We are beggars, that is true. The last thing Luther said did not mean he groveled. But even in his dying words, named the source of his joy. Can you begin to feel the difference between that? I'm glad you raised it, because both of the, well, and Marty's too. If you didn't raise those, then you don't take care of misconceptions that are so likely if you try to do all of that in two sessions. I mean, I appreciate very much you all sticking with us. That's really tough. I promised you other resources. I'll simply hold them up because I can't keep you from coffee any longer, or it wouldn't be Lutheran. The bookstore does have Regan Prenter's book, Luther's Theology of the Cross. It's a theological book, and you have to go a little slowly, but it's really very good. This one they sold out of, but sometime if you can get it. And Douglas John Hall's Light in Our Darkness. Thank you very much.